Please be seated.
Thank you, Your Honour. The next witness for Ngārunanga is Ms Bartlett, and I'm assuming she'll be the final witness for the day. I suspect that's the case.
Possibly, unless Ms McIntyre's here, I think we could quite... There were a couple of matters we wanted to explore with Ms McIntyre in terms of understanding her evidence. Now, I know that is prior to anything that the Regional Council is going to do, and the evidence may well change in response to that. But we thought it was useful just to tease out some of her thinking on some recommended changes. But thoughts?
If we've got the time, ma'am, it's probably a useful exercise. Obviously, that would, I expect it would be on the understanding that Ms McIntyre would be released from her oath.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so yeah.
Wouldn't be held over for considerable time. yes, that's fine. So I guess we'll see how we go with Ms Bartlett. Mm-hmm. All right. Do you have Ms Bartlett's statement? Yes. Thank you. Morena, Ms Bartlett, do you I'm jumping the gun.
Would you like to swear on the Bible or affirm? On the Bible, please. Just place your right hand on the Bible, please. Do you swear by Almighty God that the evidence you're about to give in the matter before the court will be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth?
I do.
Morena, Ms Bartlett, do you confirm that your full name is Maria Bartlett and that you have the experience and qualifications set out in your statement of evidence?
That's correct.
And you've produced, for the purposes of this hearing, an amended statement of evidence, so that incorporates some changes to footnotes and associated matters dated 17 February 2021?
Correct.
And do you have any additional amendments or corrections to that statement?
No, the statement stands.
Thank you. Do you confirm that, to the best of your knowledge and belief, your statement of evidence is true and correct?
I agree.
Thank you. Now, I understand, in terms of a summary of evidence, you intend to read to the court your executive summary, so perhaps... do that and then remain where you are and answer any questions from the court, my friends.
You've mentioned the 17th of February. My evidence in my folder is dated the 5th of February.
We can produce, there were some minor edits which have been tracked and updated that might not have got to you, Commissioner, but...
Two lots of evidence in the folder.
I think insofar as those changes are not substantive, and I don't understand that they are we able to just, we'll continue with questions?
Oh, yes, I'm sure I can. To be clear.
For Commissioner Edmonds' benefit, there were some missing footnotes and references which have been added in, just to, for the sake of completeness, but the actual substance of the evidence has not changed at all.
I would just... qualify that a little, because it was a reference to attachments.
Yes.
In the earlier version, there was a reference to an attachment that had all of the statutory acknowledgements in the... they weren't there in the lodged evidence, and so the amendment was to refer back to the submission where they all are sitting.
Yes.
So, yeah.
All right. Thank you.
It was one of them, anyway.
No, thank you, Ms Bartlett. If you want to read your executive summary and then remain where you are.
So I'll just run through quickly. Waihopai runaka, te runanga o Awarua runanga, and te runanga o Raka Aparima, collectively known as Ngāi Tahu ki Murihiku, are statutorily recognised as mana whenua within the Otago region, specifically Te Mata O, and I would add the Catlins, with a focus on the Upper Lakes region and true right tributaries. Ngāi Tahu ki Murihiku rights, interests and values have been adversely affected by water abstraction practices in Te Mata O over many generations, as acknowledged by the Waitangi Tribunal, and I would add as elaborated on by Mr Ellison and Mr Whanga in their evidence. The Regional Plan Water for Otago, RPW, maintains a regime for freshwater management that was established prior to the Ngāi Tahu settlement with the Crown and prior to the National Direction for Freshwater Management and the successive National Policy Statements for Freshwater 2011, 2014 and 2020. Proposed PC7 begins the process of moving on from that regime by seeking to hold the line in terms of allocation and use of freshwater while a new freshwater planning framework is developed. Ngāi Tahu ki Murihiku have not always had capacity to be involved in planned development in the Otago region, nor has their status as mana whenua, along with Ngāi Tahu ki Otago, or relevant iwi management plans, been recognised in the Otago RPS or Otago RPW. Ngāi Tahu ki Murihiku now have sufficient capacity to be actively involved in review of the Otago Regional Policy Statement and development of a new land and water regional plan for the region. Provisions of the RPW have created challenges for Ngāi Tahu ki Murihiku working with the plan over time, including in relation to notification decisions and the extent to which consideration of Ngāi Tahu rights, interests and values has been able to influence decision making. There is little evidence to suggest that the relevant provisions of the Otago RPW were designed to address Ngāi Tahu ki Murihiku rights, interests and values in freshwater. Rather, in my opinion, they support the continuation of existing consented activities, including deemed permits. I think that paragraph 18, talking about term, I'll just skip across. I think the statutory term of 35 years has been well covered. Paragraph 19, the way in which the Otago RPW manages allocation and flow regimes provides little ability to address mana whenua rights, interests and values or give effect to Te Mana o Te Wai as required by the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management 2020. Therefore, proposed PC7 is a necessary change to the RPW but can only be regarded as an interim step. Decisions by the Consent Authority to grant water permits with long durations as non-complying activities remains a concern to Ngāi Tahu ki Murihiku. And so I note here that I defer to the planning evidence of Ms McIntyre for how that issue may be managed. Kia ora.
One question, and that related to your paragraphs 82 and 83. You've found those. So when I look at your paragraph 82, you talk about the first priority for any efficiency gains in water use is that the water should go back to the water bodies to support their health and well-being. That's what you say in 82. So I'm just trying to understand now what you mean in your paragraph 83 and whether that is closely related to the reason that you're giving in 82. So in your 83, you talk about the position being predicated on the basis that there's no resource consents granted, which have long durations. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. Another thing is increasing the amount of water taken. Mm-hmm. And a third thing is the area of land irrigated. Mm-hmm. So it's that last point that I particularly want to ask you about, particularly given that there's been a suggestion that perhaps there are situations where the area of land irrigated ought to be able to be expanded as long as perhaps the amount of water required isn't.
So I think there is a close relationship between paragraph 82 and paragraph 83. And the position of Waitahu Ki Murahiku is to not just hold the line on the water abstraction, but hold the line on its area of use and application. And so that final sentence of paragraph 82 is providing some rationale for that position, which is that we have seen a tendency to, seek to, naturally, on the case of the water users, seek to maximise their water use within the allocations as they change to more efficient forms of irrigation, and that can often correspond with a greater area of use. And the mana whenua view of that is likely to further entrench the abstraction and the use, and that the context for the concern is particularly where there is heavy abstraction pressure and over-allocation, and the mana whenua experience is that that is common where deem permits are present, and in Te Mata O there are high concentrations of deem permits, and that is a taonga, a wahi tupuna or mana whenua. Has that answered the question? I'm not sure where I used that word.
Oh, I just said it a moment ago. It doesn't matter. I'll pick it up from the transcript.
Thank you. Yeah. I think I was talking about the common experience of mana whenua in processes under the current RPW framework. Yeah.
So thank you for that clarification.
Mm-hmm. I had a question. Talking about the Mata O as well. Very large water body, and I've heard in another case it's the largest water body in this country, so therefore what's the problem in terms of the take and use? Do you want to comment on that? What is the problem? Because you're dealing with that at paragraph 77. This is your amended evidence, or 78 in terms of your original brief of evidence. And here you're saying, to be effective, PC7 needs to provide guidance on avoiding granting additional water for abstraction from that river and its tribs. So what's the problem if it's the largest water body in the country for granting more water under the current plan?
So I think that in the kōrero yesterday and in Mr Ellison's kōrero this morning, the importance of the tributary, the health and well-being of the tributaries, is significant to mana whenua, and particularly given the impacts on the main stem of the water body. The you'll see in the statutory acknowledgements, put the S on the end because it's Te Wairere, Lake Dunstan, and Te Mata O, that, recorded in those statutory acknowledgements is what was lost during the establishment of the hydroelectricity scheme. And the ongoing impacts of that scheme are highlighted in Te Tangia Tauira as an issue on Te Mata O of concern. Additional to that, you'll find in Te Tangi reference to concern around abstraction and over-allocation of water bodies, and that's referring to the these tributaries. And when you look at the evidence of Mr. Whanga, and he was talking about it yesterday, and I believe Mr. Bull also made reference to the veins of Papatūānuku. So if you might think of the Tamata O as the artery, and you might think of all of the tributaries and associated wetlands, springs, ephemeral water bodies, they're all part of the circulatory system, if you like, the veins and capillaries. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a focus on the main stem would not, it does not capture Kiu Tiki Tai, and does not capture Mātauranga and the basis of, I'm going to say Te Ao Māori, but here we are talking about Te Ao Ngaitahu, the way in which mana whenua approach resource management and experience the natural world.
Thank you. Those are my questions. Commissioner? All right. So, Ms. Baker Galloway has some questions for you.
just picking up on that while you're on that theme. When Mr. Bull was talking last night, and he was talking about, when the mana of the river has been reduced, it's got less flow, it's producing less kai, and then the flow-on effect that has to him is kaitiaki and his mana. In your experience, you're at the coalface helping process these consents that come across your table. Even recently, have you seen an applicant grapple with that concept when they're assessing the effects on abstraction from water bodies?
No. I think my observation is that practice and understanding is of Te Mana o Tuai under the 2017 MPS and the 2020 and of Ngaitahu Ki Murihiku and Kaitahu Ki Otago rights, interests and values is low. And I recall of the three applications that Stevie Ray Blair and I, she's here, I just wanted to acknowledge Stevie Ray, she's here in the courtroom with us. Stevie and I attended three hearings in the second half of last year within the Dunstan Urohi. In the first of those, all of the material presented to the hearing that was coming from sources other than Ngaitahu Ki Murihiku, who were the only submitters present. In the first one, Fish and Game were present. Apologies to your client. The evidence presented was barren in relation to Te Mana o Tuai. In that instance, there was some 200 pages of case law tabled, or something like that. It was at least 100 pages. There was a bundle of material that was tabled, and Te Mana o Tuai appeared once in a footnote in that bundle. What that told me was that there was a low level of, I can only put it down to practice in the region that was blind to the MPSCFM 2017, blind to the determination of the Environment Court in proposed Southland Water and Land Plan and what those findings have been in relation to Te Mana o Te Wai under the MPSFM 2017. What I have seen in the subsequent couple of hearings is an increased acknowledgement of Te Mana o Te Wai. I have yet to see any depth in understanding or practice of that concept.
And those the 2020 hearings that you referred to, that you've got those summarised on your table one,
yep.
on page 18. Just in terms of precise timing, were they issued so that 2020 NPS came out in August 2020? Were they before or after that?
Oh, sorry, I thought it was September, 3rd of September.
Oh, it's got August on the cover. It might have been okay. September.
Jolly good. The first of those was prior to. Definitely the last one we attended, the 2020 NPS, was a factor. I honestly can't remember about the one in the middle as to which, timing-wise. Probably should have double-checked before I came this morning. But it's possible that counsel for the applicants who are present may be able to elaborate on that for the court.
Mm. And in some of those consents in your table, you explain at paragraph 76 that some had no residual or minimum flow requirements imposed.
That's correct.
Yeah. And again, from your perspective of being at the coalface, and you've gone through a lot of these processes, in an ideal world, once the Land and Water Plan is implemented, the NPS and Te Mana o Te Wai, do you envisage that Kaitahu would even need to take part to defend the mana of the Wai and the flow that's required to sustain that?
So first correction is I wouldn't say that I've been involved in a lot of processes in this region, so I just want to be really clear.
Yeah.
And actually, if you'll just allow me, I might get you to repeat the second half of your question if you just allow me a wee moment here. So I was in Te Whaka Ariki, the strategy and influence team of Te Runanga o Ngaitahu from 2012 to 2018, prior to coming down to support Aukaha in 2019 on secondment from Te Runanga o Ngaitahu. In that period from 2012 to 2018, I and my team, I was part of a strong team at Te Whaka Ariki who worked with the freshwater, or were part of the freshwater iwi leaders group, the technical group, that worked with the Crown of the day, and to bring Te Mana o Te Wai into the 2014 version of the NPS, and then again to strengthen it in the 2017 version of the NPS. Over that time, I co-authored a report in 2015, the Te Mana o Te Wai, Te Wai Pounamu case study, that was drawing from the experiences of Kaitahu ki Otago, Ngaitahu ki Murehiku, and Te Ati Awa in Waikawa. The point of that report was to assist MFE to understand the challenges faced by mana whenua in giving life to Te Mana o Te Wai in the 2014 version of the NPS. And so from, and I would note that during that period of time, 2015, something quite special was obviously happening in Murehiku as the first expression of Te Mana o Te Wai was written into the proposed Southland Water and Land Plan. Now, that was a collaboration between Alsa Kane, who is also in the court today, and I want to acknowledge her presence. So she was there working for mana whenua in Murehiku at the time for Te Ao Marama, so I'm now sitting where she was, and I was sitting in Te Runanga o Ngaitahu. So we were trying to take what was coming and what we had worked hard for within the tribal authority to establish Te Mana o Te Wai in the 2014 MPS. It was a weaker position at that time for the concept. To see that translated through to the regional planning framework, an opportunity existed in Murihiku for that to happen. It is extraordinarily heartening for me to see where that has arrived at. It's been, sorry, this is a bit of an emotional response, but the effort required of the tribal authority at Papatipurirunga to get to that point is extraordinary. So it has been wonderful to be working with Te Ao Marama in the FMU process this last year to take it to the next step of implementation. When I cross back over the regional council boundary and I look at where Kaitahu Ki Otago are with the planning framework, and being in those consent hearings last year and finding so little acknowledgement, care or respect was really dispiriting. I felt the burden of Kaitahu Ki Otago and Waitahu Ki Murihiku. So this plan change process, in my mind, is so significant for this region. And I see no reason why Otago couldn't be where Southland are right now in 5 years' time, in 6 years' time. The troubles that the irrigators are experiencing right now, I think once the fundamental concept of Te Mana o Te Wai is embedded in the RPs, which we are undertaking right now, I'm pretty excited actually about that draft. It hasn't yet hit the, you know, the outside world, but that collaboration process of Ngaitahu Ki Murihiku working with Kaitahu Ki Otago, working with the Regional Council, has been a really great process, even though it's been truncated. It's a very difficult time frame to be meeting, but ki utu ki tai, te mana o te wai, rangatiratanga, mana, they are all woven through the draft. So once that has an impact on development of the land and water regional plan, I am quite certain that the landscape that we are all working with, including the irrigators, including the council for the irrigators, that landscape is going to be significantly different. The journey taken to get to that land and water regional plan outcome will in itself be an assist to the region, to all parties undertaking resource management or engaging in resource management processes in the Otago region. It will be the, you cannot circumvent or bypass that journey. What we have learnt from, what Murihiku have learnt through that Southland regional planning process is how significant that journey is. You can't go round it. You just can't circumvent it. The journey itself is important. And in this case, that journey, yes, it's going to have to happen in a much shorter time frame. I'm quite confident that can be achieved. I've already seen what can be achieved in the drafting of the RPS. I'm quite confident that as Te Mana o Te Wai under the NPS FM 2020 is embraced and understood here, we're going to see significantly improved outcomes for mana whenua, for water bodies, and perhaps you might want to put those around the other way in recognition of the hierarchy of obligations, but for mana whenua, those two are one and the same because of whakapapa. I think that probably goes to the point that was being explored around where cultural sits in the hierarchy of obligations. I think once you understand whakapapa, there is no distinction from the mana whenua side between the health and well-being of the water body and the health and well-being of mana whenua and others. I might stop there and you can ask your second bit of whatever you want
to
say.
No, I think I'm going to stop too. Thank you, Ms Bartlett. I've got no further questions.
Mr Page, your questions? No questions. Re-examination.
Re-examination.
Well, thank you very much for your evidence. Thank you.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
So, Naam, I'll just wait for Ms Bartlett to gather her things. Shall we call Ms McIntyre?
Mm-hmm.
I'll affirm.
Okay. Do you solemnly, sincerely, and truly declare and affirm that in the matter now before the court you speak the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth?
I do.
Excuse me, ma'am. Just before I introduce Ms McIntyre's evidence, would it be helpful for Ms McIntyre to read a summary of the evidence, or is that not the court's intention? I had detected you had some quite confined questions that you wanted to put to her.
Well, we do. We're wanting just to explore the thinking around the recommended changes to policy 10A 2.3.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, quite directed, and bearing in mind that this evidence may change. Depending on what's to come from the regional council. Well, no, it won't change in substance, but the responses might change.
Right. Thank you. Well, I'll have Ms McIntyre sworn, mm-hmm. and obviously it's on the understanding that it's quite... sorry, get her to confirm her evidence on the understanding that this is quite confined questions.
Yep.
Was the court also anticipating any cross-examination?
They certainly... I think that's a matter for counsel.
Okay.
They may also wish to explore the recommended changes as well, just to have a better sense of that going forward. And bearing in mind, we're expecting Ms McIntyre to come back.
Indeed.
That's not foreclosing on any of that, nor on the ability to change her responses in response to something else coming out of the Regional Council. That's anticipated.
No, and completely understood, ma'am. I just wanted to make sure we were on the same page in terms of what this exercise is intended to achieve.
Yeah.
So... Right. Good afternoon, Ms McIntyre. Do you confirm that your name is Sandra McIntyre and that you have the qualifications and experience set out in your statement of evidence dated 17 February 2021?
Yes.
Okay. And like Ms Bartlett, you made some amendments to your original statement of evidence, so what we should be looking at is an amended statement of evidence dated 17 February 2021.
That's correct.
And are there any further amendments or corrections you wish to make to that statement?
There were just, I discovered when rereading through my evidence, there was a page that somehow mysteriously didn't reflect the amended version. So there are just a small number of references to other evidence that didn't get in there. So if I can take you to paragraph 63.
I just need to say that I don't have that version of the evidence either.
I see.
It's our fault.
The 17th of February version.
Right.
So it may not be significant, but it might just be something we need to be aware of.
It may help the court that the only amendments that there were in that evidence were essentially some amendments to the cross-references to other evidence of the Kaitahu case, because those had not reflected the final version of the evidence. So
the substance of the paragraphs remains the
yes.
same, is that right?
Yes, there is no change at all to that.
Okay, look, thank you for that.
There's an additional copy here, Commissioner Edmonds, which you're welcome to have, of the 17 February version.
Thank you very much.
So we're at paragraph 63, Ms McIntyre,
yes.
page 26.
There was actually one correction in paragraph 63, which isn't related to the cross-references, and this is that I noticed that in the fourth line, I refer to the RWP framework. That, of course, should be the RPW, the Regional Plan Water. Then in the following sentence, my evidence refers to Mr. Allison and Mr. Fanger's evidence. In fact, that should just refer to Mr. Allison's evidence.
Thank you.
Then if we move to paragraph 64... Again, there is a reference to Mr. Allison's and Ms. Bartlett's evidence. Again, that should just refer to Mr. Allison's evidence, and that occurs twice in that paragraph. And the reference to Mr. Allison's evidence that should be footnoted there is to paragraphs 114 to 117 of his evidence and paragraph 133.
114 to...
To 117.
And for footnote 59 to...
And to 133.
Thank you.
And there is one more correction at... On the...
footnote 60.
I'm just looking at whether I've got the right... There is a reference to... Sorry, I'm just working out which paragraph we're at now. It's a couple of pages over. On page 30 of the amended evidence, footnote 64. There is a reference to Mr. De Palsemaker's evidence, which has just got a question mark against the paragraph. That should that question mark should be replaced by paragraphs 89 to 90.
Was that footnote 65?
64.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry. That's all.
Thank you. So, subject to those corrections and amendments, do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
Thank you. Please remain and answer any questions from the court.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to explore the amendments you've proposed to the non-complying policy just to understand what you intend by them and the reasons for those amendments. So perhaps the easiest thing to do is just to turn to 10A2.3 in your Appendix 4 and start from the top. So perhaps if we start with A1.
Yes.
And perhaps this is the easy one. Schedule 2A, I did ask the council's planning witness about that, and we turned up Schedule A. 2A, and we see that there are minimum flows applying to catchments in Schedule 2A.
Yes.
So perhaps, yep. My understanding correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So the consents officer would turn that up and see whether the activities for the catchment area is identified in Schedule 2A and whether the activities that are proposed comply with the minimum flow.
Yes.
So is there any amplification you need to make on that?
Well,
in terms of the reasons?
What I was trying to do in looking at ways to improve this policy is I began on that path basically because of the problem that has already been traversed in the court about having a policy which essentially just repeats the other of Section 104.2, so just refers to no more than minor adverse effects and the difficulties that takes us into in terms of applying that non-complying policy. So I was trying to identify circumstances in which, well, this is also against the context of my evidence in which I've generally agreed with the Regional Council that there are some significant gaps still to be filled in terms of the information that is available to be able to give us some confidence in making decisions about long-term consents that will actually provide for Te Mana o Te Wai and the difficulty of doing that in the current framework. So what I was looking to do was to find, to identify some circumstances in which we might have a degree of confidence that there had been sufficient work done to be able to say, well, you know, we might have some circumstances here in which we could, subject to the particular characteristics of the application, we could potentially contemplate that we've got enough confidence that there won't be significant, that well, there won't be more than minor adverse effects, that we can actually look potentially at a long-term duration of consent. So that was my starting point. And I found it quite difficult to try and identify those circumstances. And in the end, the Schedule 2A regimes seemed to me to be really the only clear circumstance that was pointed to in the plan where there had been a process which looked at the water bodies more broadly than just at that individual consenting, you know, what are the effects at this point of take type approach. So because in the development of the Schedule 2A regimes there had been a broader consideration of what the needs of the water body are, and there had been a broader public process in terms of testing that information and looking at, you know, some evaluation of the different values that different sectors of the community have in relation to that, that this could be a circumstance where we had a degree of confidence. Now, I did have some reservations about that, which have been heightened from the evidence of Mr. De Pauwelsmaeker and others at the Regional Council in terms of the robustness of the regimes in Schedule 2A, and from work that I have been involved with the Regional Council and looking at the work that is starting to happen on the FMU processes now, then I have some distinct reservations about whether some of those regimes in Schedule 2A will actually give us the confidence that we are providing appropriately for the needs of the water body. So I have, since preparing this evidence, also had a look at the other alternatives that have been proposed by other witnesses, and the more I think about it, the more I am preferring the approach that Dr. Hayes and Mr. Farrell for Fish and Game have proposed, which is an approach that looks at what the degree of change to the flow conditions in the water body is. It seems to me that there is a logic to that approach, which gives us a bit more confidence that we are keeping in that, you know, in the area of where we can have some confidence that the effects will not be more than minor. So I am quite attracted to that approach as a better alternative than what I've proposed here.
Okay, but I think I'll just first deal with my question. So for now, I thought we might just park A2 and look at B, because that deals with the Schedule 2A maximum primary allocation.
Yes. My reasoning for that is essentially the same reasoning as I think Dr. Hayes has talked about in his evidence, that a minimum flow requirement without an accompanying limit on the amount of allocation doesn't effectively look after the needs of the water body, because essentially you get into the situation where you have a flatlining of the approach. If you can take as much water as is available above that minimum flow, then you're not actually providing for the natural variability of flow that is needed to support the water body. So I felt that it was really important to ensure that if we were going to take this sort of approach, we needed to make sure that the limit on allocation was part of that consideration.
So some of those primary allocations, in terms of the numbers that there are in Schedule 2, they are basically exceeded by many, many times.
Yes, they
are. Are they not?
Yes, they are. And the implication of that would be that if somebody wanted to take this route, there would have to... it seems to me that it's something that could potentially apply in a situation such as the grouped consent applications in the Manuhiri Care, where the consent applicants have been working together, and in terms of what they are going to do in terms of the regime across the catchment. So in those circumstances where you have a number of applicants looking at things together, then it is, I think, possible for them to look at how the overall allocations that they're applying for relate to those allocation limits in Schedule 2A, and to see how they can work together to fit within that. I think if they, in the circumstance where they can't come up with anything to do that, we don't have any confidence, we can't really have any confidence at all that they are not going to have more than minor adverse effects on the water body.
So what's your thinking on this now in the light of what you've said about the evidence of Dr. Hayes and Mr. Farrell?
I think the thinking behind it is essentially the same. I think Mr. Farrell and Dr. Hayes' approach is a more precautionary approach, and I support that more precautionary approach. I accept that in terms of trying to apply an allocation limit in this context, it's something that is pretty difficult to do if you are looking at individual applications individually, it seems to me that the value comes in if you are looking at something like that Manuhirikia situation. I think where you are looking at an individual application, which wouldn't provide the circumstances in this regime, there would still be the potential for the applicant to argue in terms of the other limb of Section 104 2B, in terms of that the effects are not more than minor, and that's essentially where they would be left to. I suppose the context to having what I accept as quite a very high bar for the non-complying activity is that, and I think my evidence has hopefully made clear in my view that in general we should not be at this stage of the process be granting long-term consents. We need to be allowing the new planning framework to be developed. So
that was another question I had. Perhaps it's a good time to ask it. Your reason for the 2030?
Yes, and having a look at the 2035 timeframe, 15 years, the situation in Otago is an interesting situation. In Otago, until very recently, it seems to have been absolutely accepted practice that people will get 35-year consents. And because that has been the accepted practice, then it seems also to have been, I suppose, generally accepted that if you have anything less than 35 years, you're actually imposing some quite significant limitations. And when I started looking at Plan Change 7, I thought, well, you know, 15 years, that's a lot better than 35 years. Once I started thinking about it a little bit further, I kept being reminded in terms of that is actually, that situation is quite out of step with what's happening in other parts of the country and in the neighbouring regions, that I think, as Mr. Allison has already mentioned this morning, in Canterbury, it's very common that consents are granted for less than 10 years. I understand the same is the case in Southland. The 15-year consent term, while it is a significantly better situation than a 35-year consent, still potentially takes you out beyond the life of the next land and water regional plan. So it still essentially means we are going through the development of a new framework, and unless Mr. Page is right and all of this can be dealt with in terms of consent reviews, which I've suggested I don't agree with, unless you can do that, then a 15-year term is still taking you into the next iteration of the planning framework, so it undermines what happens in this land and water plan. So for that reason, I've recommended that the consent term be reduced to 10 years, so then we can be certain that all the consents that are being granted between now and when the new framework gets put in place will be reassessed during the life of that plan.
And so do you see an issue with it being 6 years?
An issue with the consent, the controlled activity being 6 years?
No. Is there a reason for an additional 4 years for a non-complying as opposed to the controlled activity? I was just wanting to understand your rationale in terms of the additional 4 years.
The reason for the justification for having a non-complying path is that there are quite possibly some circumstances in which there may be a good reason why a longer duration might be able to be granted, and that may be potentially some of the circumstances that have been raised by the parties who are looking at things like hydroelectricity and drinking water supplies. I have some reservations about the extent of the caveats that they're looking for there, but there are potentially some situations in there where there might be a good argument that a longer term is justified. There may be some circumstances in which we do have confidence that the effects are not going to be more than minor in terms of the way we are needing to look at effects under the new MPS, which is, I think, a much stronger test than we have had in the past. But there may be some circumstances in which we can be confident. For example, if somebody is wanting to abstract a reasonably small volume of water from something like Lake Wanaka or something, you know, where we can be confident that there are not going to be effects. So there may be circumstances there in which it is reasonable for someone to be able to put up the argument that they could have a longer term. Really, it's just if you don't do that, then you end up being in the situation of having a controlled activity and a prohibited activity, and I think that's a pretty difficult thing to justify in terms of the framework that we work under the RMA. So I thought we need to provide a non-complying path. It's just how can we make that something that we know isn't going to get us into a worse state than we are in at the moment.
So perhaps we could come back to A2 now.
Yes. A2. A2 is essentially a circumstance such as the one that I was just referring to, and for example, where you may have a take which has come from a tributary that is running into somewhere like Lake Wanaka, and the applicants propose to shift the take from that small tributary and to then take directly from the lake. In that circumstance, there is a clear reduction in the effects of that activity. And similarly, if somebody has been, and you know, we have seen some applications recently of the type where somebody is talking about shifting from a tributary of the Mata'o to then take directly from the Mata'o itself, which obviously has a lot more water, as Your Honour has mentioned this morning, has quite a lot of water in it. So in those circumstances as well, I thought it is useful to encourage applicants to be looking at those sorts of changes in their activities, so that it's shifting us more into the sort of situation that we are probably likely to be having to look at under a new framework when we're having to look at properly addressing over allocation. It seems to me entirely likely that when we get into that framework, one of the potential solutions that we'll be looking at to reduce over allocation would be encouraging applicants to shift from small water bodies to water bodies that can accommodate a whole lot more water use. So it's sort of shifting a little bit in that direction, essentially.
So what do you mean by reducing the environmental impacts? Is there any sort of magnitude of reduction, and what environmental impacts would you be considering as part of that consideration?
I would be looking at it in terms of the policies in the MPS, as the first stages, the objective and policies in the NPS, it would be, I would be asking myself the question, is the shift going to enable us to better provide for Te Mana o Te Wai and to better give effect to the policies in the NPS? That would be my starting point.
There has been a suggestion earlier that there's a lot of work still to be done in terms of FMUs.
Yes.
In fact, to work out what attributes and values you want and what you require to achieve those. So how would that interact with what you've just said in relation to reducing environmental impacts?
I think the further we get through the process of developing the frameworks for the FMUs, the better equipped we are going to be to assess those things. The approach that the Regional Council is taking in terms of their FMU program is to do that work in parallel with the broader development of the broader land and water plan framework. So there is some work on the Manuhirikia FMU has started now. There has been work done on the Arrow and Cardrona, Rohi rather than FMU. In the Arrow and Cardrona situation, for example, the Regional Council has actually identified a recommended flow regime. At the moment, that has no legal standing because it's sitting in the Council. It has gone to the councillors. It has some legitimacy, I think, because it's been through the process, and it seems to me that as the work in those FMU processes develops, and similarly in the Manuhirikia, there has been quite a lot of work that has already been done at this stage in terms of identifying the values of the Manuhirikia and the objectives associated with those values. So I think as the work progresses in those, all of that provides information that can be taken into account in processing these concerns. It's not information that has statutory weight, but I consider that it's still relevant information that can be taken into account in making those decisions, particularly when it has been through the community process that is involved in those FMU processes. So it will become easier to do this over the next couple of years, essentially, I think.
Thank you, Ms. McIntyre.
And I have some questions as well, also on the same provisions, and I just wanted to understand your thinking as it is today, acknowledging that it might change when Regional Council files supplementary evidence. And so just starting off with the last matter, which the Commissioner addressed under the policy 10023 and environmental impacts. And you said you would look to the NPS to describe or for guidance on what are the relevant impacts and the relevance of those impacts. Mr. De Plasmaker had quite a different approach. When using his understanding of environmental effects, would exclude matters which are otherwise permitted under the water plan, and so this was, I think, when we were in discussion about the RDA, and you know, there's got to be a reduction of environmental effects, and we said what effects, thinking, you know, does that then take into an approach in an integrated way all potential effects of an increase in land under irrigation? Initially he said yes, and then he said no,
you know, certainly didn't mean to somehow bring back into play, if I could put it that way, effects which are otherwise permitted in this plan, the water plan. And so has what you got here, how does it drive consideration under the NPS?
That's a good question. I think we could include better direction on that in their policy.
I'm just reflecting better direction because I think if you're wanting to continue with this, applicants would just simply say, well, that's permitted,
yep.
therefore acceptable, therefore off the table. So whatever, therefore, you know, environmental yep. impacts meant, it didn't mean those other things that are permitted.
Yeah,
I could see that argument being run pretty easily.
Yes, I have, in looking at what is the sort of scope of amendments that it's appropriate to make to this
plan
change?
Well, there's that too, and everybody's got to come back to this. Yeah.
And I have been very, very conscious of the fact that we don't want to turn it into something that
it's
isn't. It is the hold the line approach. We don't want to, and I think it would be dangerous to try and prejudge what other things that might come in development of the new framework and trying to develop that new framework through this plan change. So
is this kind of like hold the line plus, this what you've got here, which is trying to make sense of a policy which frankly does not make sense, you know, because it's a Clayton's policy, it's not actually a policy.
Yes. My concern in looking at this policy was the experience that we have had in terms of what is actually happening with the deemed permits, and that was evident from, I think, the figures that Mr. Leslie provided earlier this week. The majority of consents being granted and the majority of consents being applied for are being applied for long-term. So clearly this non-complying policy is not working. So I was focused on seeing how we might be able to tighten it up and give better direction. I accept fully that my suggestions are not the perfect suggestions, and it has been quite a difficult thing to try and work out how to do while not taking this plan change further than it's appropriate to take it.
I had also been wondering whether it was a step too far. I can certainly understand the rationale from moving a take-off a trip and into the main stem, but that presupposes something about the health of the ecosystem in the main stem, which and the evidence for that would be what? And again, you know, I can also imagine we'll get arguments like for the Clutha main stem, well, that's just a large body of water.
I agree. I and I also have that concern. I think I've had some difficulty in working out how to clearly draft this policy. And from looking at the alternatives that other people have proposed, I think everybody's been struggling with this a little bit. What I and some of the other witnesses have been trying to do is to see if we can tighten it up. At the same time, we need to be clear that what we're not doing is making it a default position. What I was wanting to do in this was to get across that these are circumstances in which a longer term duration could be contemplated. It shouldn't be that it's assumed that a longer duration consent in these circumstances will always be appropriate. This is a non-complying activity. You have to give it a full assessment in terms of the effects. So these are circumstances in which it could be contemplated, but you would need to look at all those other things, like what is the particular context of this application, what is the in the state of the environment here, and what are the effects going to be. So this is, but to try and draft the policy so that we were providing some clearer direction as to circumstances in which it might be contemplated without saying, yes, we will grant consent in these circumstances for a longer term, has proven to be a bit difficult.
No, and I get that. And I guess we've yet to see what's to come in terms of a policy from the region that follows the mandate of its executive. And so that might actually take some of the effort away. But it's not to be inferred that Kaitahu says that if you're taking water off a main stem, then everything is okay.
No.
And I'm wondering whether that's actually part of the challenge of the words that we see here, and then what did environmental effect mean, and how would you run that in an application, particularly absent an objective that's actually articulating clearly an outcome for the environment. You know, it's kind of a lot of words there, but it seems to be a process-driven, it's a process-driven objective, not process plus.
Yes.
Okay, so I think you're accepting that there's problems, potential problems with this, but it's trying to improve what was there, which I think is also what Mr. Farrell's evidence is trying to do. It's a reaction to the original draft.
Yes, we're looking for what gains we can get, essentially.
Okie dokie. There were my questions. Did you have anything else?
No, I didn't. Okay. It was very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Mm-hmm. Yep. So those are the court's questions. Does anyone want to ask this witness questions to understand the thinking behind where Ms. McIntyre was when she landed on this page, as opposed to where she might be now? And I'm grateful, you know, you've indicated that there's been a shift anyway at the commencement of your evidence. Mr. Page?
I'm torn slightly. I mean, there are questions that I want to ask Ms. McIntyre, but on the other hand, I'm also conscious that we're going to get another draft on Monday of the proposal, and it all might be a waste of time. And so the questions that the court had around the non-complying activity policy were obviously of interest to hear that now, but
it might change, and it might.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
If you're wanting to deal with that policy now...
Not really. I'm just trying to... for my part, was just trying to understand the witness's rationale for this non-complying policy.
Yes.
You know, particularly, does this witness say that if you move all takes off trib, then everything's fine from her client's perspective? Answer, no. This is a policy that is in response to... you know, the notified version of this proposed plan, which otherwise was, and I understand that, but I just wanted to make sure there was, you know, I was clear in my own mind, is there any inference as to what is okay to be taken from this? And I think the answer to that is no, you shouldn't take that inference. This is simply a reaction to something which has been put up by the region. I think when you get to, you know, it's over to you whether you want to ask some questions now, but I would have thought when we get something from the region and everybody's had a chance to look at that, and Ms. McIntyre filed some supplementary papers about that, you know, it's open to you to explore if there is a change in position, why the change in position, if you like, and put the original brief to any supplementary brief. Does that help?
I think it tells me I should wait.
Tells you you should. Very good. Also, it's lunchtime, but that's not a good enough reason. Okay, tells you should wait. Very good. Any anybody else? Nobody? Oh, no, Mr. Moore, you wanted to say something.
Certainly. Just one question which might clarify or amplify where the court seemed to be going, but I'm happy to wait for Mr. Moore because...
he knows something?
No. I detect he may have a question along those lines.
All right, so. Okay.
No, I was just going to flag that the questions I was minded to explore today have been explored in the questions that the bench has put to the witness, and it would be unfair, I think, for me to explore some of the thinking based on a draft I have in front of me, but that the witness hasn't had a chance to consider.
Oh, fair. Yeah, no, it would be actually.
At best, wait.
Yeah, all right. Okay, and anything, Mr. Winchester?
Well, yes, with that in mind, I think it may just tease out Your Honour's questions, particularly around Clause Roman numeral 2 of the policy. Mm. And bearing in mind that, Ms. McIntyre, you've responded that the intention is not to signal that a main stem take is acceptable as an alternative to a take from a tributary. If you think about that issue that you're looking to address in Roman numeral 2 as between the concept of risk and effects, can you advise the court where the balance lies in terms of your thinking, what you're seeking to address with Roman numeral 2?
Well, I guess if we're looking at it in terms of risk, and I think it's probably quite helpful to look at it in that way, is we essentially, I'm suggesting that the risks are likely to be less if you move to the lake or the main stem or the groundwater than the risks are in the smaller tributaries.
Yes, but not necessarily acceptable.
Not necessarily acceptable, no.
Thank you.
It needs to be considered case by case.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. McIntyre.
All right, thank you. Well, thank you very much. We are going to see you back again, probably next week, maybe. Oh, gosh, that sounds like I'm really certain that I know what's going on in this hearing. So probably over to you, Mr. Moore. What's going on?
Lots of things going on, but pertinent to this issue, the intention is to have a further... further running dog of the plan change, so to speak, circulated on Monday. So we'll work on that over the weekend with a view to getting that out to parties really just as quickly as we can. Mm. Once that occurs, it's then going to be a question of timetabling in terms of when we can sensibly get the planners back in front of us, albeit... it'll depend on how we undertake that process as to whether we just continue proceeding party by party, or whether there's merit in having the planners either all called together or called sequentially. So I don't have a fixed view at all on that at present. It's largely going to depend on perhaps some responses to the next draft that's circulated.
Mm. Have you been circulating drafts as of...
No, not yet.
Okay, right. Okay.
The consent.
Usefully be done. your consents vote giving supplementary evidence. When's that was due yesterday? Indicated to be with us yesterday.
Yes, Ms. Mallett's working with two witnesses at present on that, with a view to getting that finalised as soon as possible for filing.
Is that today? Is that what that means, or do you actually sensibly need the weekend? Because all of this impacts on other people too.
Mm. Yes. Can't immediately answer whether they'll be there today. If you give me a quick moment, I can send an email very quickly to find out. And then my understanding was that evidence would be slotted in on Tuesday morning, subject to other adjustments to the timetable being made to accommodate that.
Yep. And then, I think in terms of fairness to other counsel who may have questions, the timing's obviously critical. If we get that Tuesday, it's not going to give them any time. So... we even get a Monday, they'll have other things to do on Monday in terms of this process. So it's important to get an answer back, and I guess council can reserve their position as to whether or not they need more time than Tuesday if they have follow-up questions as well. They're in the best position to be able to advise the court. We're sitting Monday, aren't we? Yep. We're sitting Monday. Yeah. Okay, so let us know, an update hopefully either during the day or 9 a.m. on Monday, and then we can touch base with council as to how they're positioned. But it's not just council, it's any party which might have had an interest in this as well. So that's that. As to whether we hear from planning witnesses sequentially, really a matter for the council to decide, having an opportunity to review and again respond, and being aware of the difference between a response and a reaction. I'm quite happy for a fluid hearing process and taking witnesses as they come. But it's about potential prejudice.
Yes, there's a balance between perhaps the prejudice and the efficiency that might be created by proceeding in that manner. But until parties have actually had a chance to see what's now being proposed, we can't really advance that.
It probably goes without saying that whatever's actually proposed by a policy planner needs to be checked through by a consents or a regulatory person, so that the what is proposed is actually able to be implemented and is certain and enforceable, clear, certain and enforceable. So I think that actually goes without saying. And what I think, from my own part, speaking for myself, would be quite helpful, possibly also for the person who's fronting that brief of evidence as well, is a brief explanation of how they think it works. Because I know from Mr. De Plaisemaker, we were working through how does it work. And had that check been done front-end, some of these problems might have actually revealed themselves, if you like.
Yes.
Front-end by Mr. De Plaisemaker. This is how it works. Yeah.
Yeah, so just so I'm clear about that, the court would be assisted if the consents planner was able to provide some comment in relation to the next iteration that comes through. That's actually not too big a ask, noting that we have time this afternoon with the person from the consents team to work through the new iteration of the plan to make sure that this question about practical workability can be addressed. So we should be able to pick that up and file some supplementary evidence together with those changes, just stepping through how it might actually work. And that, in terms of the outcome from this entire process, assuming that some version of Plan Change 7 makes it through, it needs to be practically workable. So,
yeah, that's right. And there needs to be a clear understanding by the Regional Council how it would administer it. And so it's those sort of questions that we've had. You know, if you don't have a minimum flow and there's a matter of discretion about a minimum flow, will there be a minimum flow? And the evidence was no, and then the evidence was yes. You know, so it's those, or when we're looking at effects, so there's a new RDA provision about environmental effects, or what effects? And the evidence initially was all effects, and then the evidence was, well, certainly not those effects which are permitted. And, so it's like, what are the four corners of this?
Yes.
And is whatever's proposed sitting within its mandate and is now neatly confined within those corners, and it's clear, certain and enforceable?
Yes, and the optimist in me is fairly well certain that those issues should be addressed in what's coming through. And it's been useful in highlighting those issues. But again, in terms of having the consents officer's eyes over that from the practical perspective of, well, what do you do with an application that then comes in? What does that look like?
And I understand this is what it requires of me as a consents officer, and this is what I would ask.
All right, well, we will we'll do what we can to get that information through with the further refinements, call it that way. Now, I haven't had a response from Ms. Malhip, who may well be in transit at present back to here in relation to the timing of the other two briefs of evidence.
Yeah.
I'll update the court through the registry just as soon as I know when those briefs will be ready.
Okay. And then once Council have an opportunity to consider them, can advise whether Tuesday, in fact, is a suitable date for actually hearing that supplementary evidence, or do you require more time to formulate questions or to take advice from your own experts as to the content of those briefs, both the and that those briefs will include the consents officer briefs together with supplementary evidence from a policy planner to do with the PC7, a rework of that PC7.
Yep. Yes.
So you think the three will come together?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, no, that sounds good. And then starting, looks like a Tuesday date for that, and then planners, depending on timing, can follow that, and you can talk to Mr. Cooper as to individual time restrictions, because there may well be for some of the planners. But Monday morning, otherwise, who we're starting with?
I think.
My 5 minutes is I believe that's the 6th and 4th.
Right. Yeah, and probably just the one witness, maybe, with Mr. Enzor to.
I'm going to be catching up with Ms. Nixon later on today, Your Honour. I had already suggested that it might be wise to perhaps delay Mr. Ensor for the Tuesday, and I think I'll reinforce that to her, particularly now knowing that we have this additional information coming on Monday morning, and knowing that Mr. Ensor to have the opportunity to consider and reflect and then present evidence on that.
Well, I suspect her first witness won't take all day. So, who's coming after that?
So then, for the Director General, we have Dr. Dunn, who also is wanting some priority because he's wanting to get away by midday Tuesday.
He's your freshwater ecologist.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. After that, we have Mr. Brass, and I've already flagged to the court Mr. Brass's timing restrictions, but. Yeah, we're working on those as best we can.
Okay, and then but he's your planning, and
he's up. So we just had freshwater ecology and planning. We didn't have any other.
But you might not run your planning Monday. You might running fall on Monday.
So Mr. Brass was expecting to present on Tuesday, but again, given where we've now landed, he actually may want to not present and go away, do Marlborough, and come back on Friday, but that will just require a bit of juggling of
that's okay.
Else.
Yeah. All right, and then still looking to get to you, Ms. Baker Galloway, on Monday.
Well, no, ma'am.
No.
I'm calling
Wellington
on Monday.
Well, no, we won't.
So I won't be here. And it might leave me, I'll just have to check in terms of questions for Dr. Dunn, because I was banking on him being on Tuesday, so I'll just work through that with my friends.
So we might get to you, the earliest we'll get to you is Tuesday. Okay, so then we'd be looking to bring forward Wise response, maybe. And, Wise, that'll probably fill up Monday.
I was hoping to ask Mr. McTavish questions as well. But that could be dealt with, actually. I can probably ask a favour.
You could. Yes, that's fine as well. Okay, no, that sounds fine. High degree of cooperation on this view.
Thank you.
No, that sounds all good. So, so we've got a broad batting order anyway for Monday, and then coming back into the, not the ECAN case, the ORC case. I'm looking at you going, ECAN, sorry, Mr. Moore. Coming back into the ORC case on Tuesday. Probably, possibly, yeah.
Yes, I'm just...
Maybe.
I do have a slight update. Unlikely to be today, but certainly before Monday, which is ambiguous, so I will get greater clarity just precisely when they'll be ready. And,
sounds like working in the weekend.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah. And of course, these things are better well done than undercooked or...
Quite.
Or overcooked, as the case might be, but well done. So, all right. And I can't emphasise how important it is not to rush it, you know, to make it your best foot going forward. Yep. All right. Very good. Thank you very much. So we're adjourned for today anyway, and back here at 9:30 on Monday. Right. Oh no, there's one more thing.
So I'm just being briefly to acknowledge that we've come to the end of our kaitahu contribution to your work, and acknowledge the significance of your work, which is impressed upon me even more now, having been here for a couple of days and realising the enormity of your work. So we wish you well and all parties to the process, that we reach a really good outcome. So I acknowledge that work that you had before you, and invite Mr. Whānau to whakakapi puta te mei hui.
I tātou te mihi o whakurangatira ki a koutou, te kōti i tēnei wā, koutou katoa hurinoa i tō tātou whare. Ka tika, ka huri tō tātou, whakaro ki tō tātou atua ki a kape, te kōrero o te rā nei, a ki a puta ki rongi te kete, ki te mātaranga o te iwi, a ki a puta ki a whāngai hia, a te kaupapa e runga i te kōrahi mui a tātou. Leina mai e mai e, ko koe o ia te timutanga na whakamutinga, ke whiwhi ai te hihi, te wehe, te manata tapu, ki a mō tātou mō ngā ure a muri aki nei. Ko tēnei tēnu atu ki a koe te atua, Tiaki manaki tō tātou whare, tiaki manaki tō tātou kōti, ki rongi te kauapa te rā nei, kia puta te kākano, kia tupu, kia puawai, kia puta tā hua, ki rongi te huarahi nui a tātou. Lei te atu e manaki tia i a mātou e ngā wā katoa. Kia huri kia koe i rongo, kia whakairi aki ki ronga, whakamawa kia tēnā, kaume e hui e,
hae ki e. Te aroha, te whakapono, me te rangi mai e, tātou e, te aroha, te whakapono, me te rangi mai e,
Anō whānau hara mai te tōki, haumi e hui e,
pārai ki
e. All rise.